Hey everybody, welcome to Surface Level, curious conversations about the Black and queer experience. I'm one of your hosts, Damon, and today, Jordan, Tony, and I are discussing how the intersections of sexuality, gender, race, and class affect queer revolution.
We all need the freedom to figure out ourselves on our own terms. Yeah. Like, I'm fabulous and fly and beautiful now, but who would I have been if I could have been more of myself from the start?
Today, we're exploring Sylvia Rivera as a part of our reflection.
What I would love to see happen more is that members of our community understand that you can create your own table now.
You don't need academia to be a voice, to be valuable.
I think in the future, we're going to have less conversations around this new kind of invisible binary that they are cis and they are trans people.
And today, we're really excited to welcome someone that we wanted on our show from day one, from the beginning, Raquel Willis, to our Surface Level family.
This is The Risk It Takes to Bloom. All right.
Hello.
We're back.
We are back.
In our new space and with our first guest in our new space. And Tony, do your thing.
I'm going to do the honors. So let's go ahead and get into it. There's so many things one can say about our guest today. So many accolades, but I'm going to try and cull it down a little bit. So just bear with me. Today's guest is an award-winning activist and journalist and a leading voice for collective liberation, particularly for trans individuals. As the executive producer of iHeartMedia's first ever LGBTQ+ podcast network, Outspoken, and host of Afterlives, she passionately shares the stories of trans lives lost to violence. She's an accomplished author with her recent book, The Risk It Takes to Bloom, on life and liberation, which you can see here on our beautiful table. And her impactful career and commitment to storytelling makes her a driving force in the fight for justice and equality. And today, we're really excited to welcome someone that we wanted on our show from day one, from the beginning, Raquel Willis, to our Surface Level family.
Yes, thank you.
Welcome.
We got you here.
You got me.
By hook or crook.
Okay. Not crook.
By hook or crook. We was going to make sure we got you on this show, and you're here, so thank you so much for being with us.
Of course, and I've wanted to be on for as long as y'all wanted me, so it's been mutual love.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Raquel, we always start with a game. So just a little background. This season is titled A Reflection. So each of our episodes, we're exploring a queer icon, their work, their life, through a bit of our game and then through a bit of our conversation. And today we're exploring Sylvia Rivera as a part of our reflection. So she will color parts of our game, and that's where we're going to start to get warmed up before we get into the full conversation.
Cool. Let's go.
All right.
Let's do it.
So Sylvia Rivera, for many of our listeners, just as a checkpoint, a veteran of the Stonewall Inn uprising, tireless advocate for those silenced and disregarded by larger movements throughout her life, fighting for trans people who are often excluded from the bigger gay rights movement. So I wanted to take points of her life and kind of ask you some open-ended and some fun things in relation to her work.
Okay.
So the Star House was something that she founded with Marsha P. Johnson to house many of their kids who ran away from home. Mm-hmm. What place other than New York have you felt the most at home in your queerness or gender identity?
Ooh.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. I'll start and give you all a minute because we typically don't do open-ended for the game. I would say Boston. And it was the first place I lived after Howard. And I liked it because, not liked it, but I got to come into my own because I didn't know anybody there. Mm-hmm. So, like, it was one of those things where I got to explore without feeling like people were watching me, which was really nice. And I met, like, one of the most amazing people there who I always talk about. But
me? No, I'm kidding.
No.
I was not in Boston.
As much as you pretend you didn't know me, Tony, I had already known you for 4 years at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of 4 years of knowing me at that point, I think my answer would be D.C.
Mm.
And that's because it was the first place that I went to after leaving my home in Virginia, where it's like, whenever I go to D.C., I feel like it's... You know that feeling you get when you go back to home and family, where it feels very much like love and safe and warm? That's the feeling I get when I go to D.C. I've met some of my lifelong friends and just had so many experiences there that shaped my life. So that's my second home
and where like my heart really is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
DC as well. I mean, that's the first place I got it popping. It's also.
What do you mean?
Huh?
I got it popping.
What was popping?
It just meant that, you know, I was coming into myself.
You fully bloomed.
I was.
Oh. You were blooming.
Come on,
absolutely. Multiple times.
Ooh.
No, I'm kidding. But not really. No, but DC was like that. I was like at home, like, oh, I cannot wait to go to college so I can, like, you know, kiss a boy and, like, you know, be gay. So definitely DC. And I go back now today and I'm like, oh, okay, like, this is like.
Still go down there kissing boys.
Where I became who I am today.
Good for you.
I love it. Such good answers. So mine is Atlanta, of course, for many reasons. For me, I mean, I know we know of it as like a black gay Mecca, but it's a black trans Mecca to me. And that was the first place where I met black, queer, and trans folks. And Atlanta radicalized me, y'all. Like, that was where I gleaned a politic around mass incarceration and abolition and everything, and met lifelong friends and mentors for the first time. So it's Atlanta for me. And I was a mess in my 20s, too. So I got it popping.
You got it popping.
Okay. Right. That's a part of the process.
All right. So I'm going to keep it hard for one more, another open-ended. So Sylvia Rivera often would refer to Marsha P. Johnson as, she said, she was like a mother to her. Yeah. If you could pick any queer mother, father person, who would they be?
Aww.
I will go again, give everybody a minute. James Baldwin. I've been obsessed with the energy, the work, the delivery. Like, I can watch him speak for hours. One of my favorite things ever is the conversation he did with Nikki Giovanni. Like, it's sensational TV, like appointment viewing. And I think so much of, like, if you, the clip I have, and I think it's on my Instagram from years ago, where he's going on about, like, how long do I have to wait for your progress? And talking about just, like, liberation. I think that if I were a clip, it would be that video.
Yeah.
Jordan?
His name is Jarrell Chesney. When I first moved to New York, I found myself around like a group of supportive gay black men that were a little bit older than me. If I was 22, maybe they were like in their mid-30s. And they really took me in. They cooked for me. They talked to me about like my relationships, my career. And they were wonderful examples of how to grow into your queerness confidently. I don't think I had many role models before I came to New York. I had peers in DC, but New York was the first time where I felt like I found people that I looked up to and I was like, wow, like, you know, in 10 years, in 15 years, like, I'm gonna be as confident and proud in my queerness as they are. And so shout out to Jarrell, great cooking and great spirit. I invited you all over to those to those functions all the time.
We should taught you how to cook.
Cook down. Well, you know, you love delivery.
But you do love your queerness, so we won the battle. We won the war, maybe not the battle.
Exactly.
Yeah. For me, I would say, I had one name in mind when Damon asked the question, and then when Damon gave his answer, I went to a different place. So I'm going to give both, but the first one I was thinking was Anthony Woodburn, which you all know, he went to Howard. I call him my fairy gay mother because he really took me under his wing, taught me the ropes on how to do this thing that we do. And that's invaluable to have someone who can really show you the light. And so my second person, who is a famous celebrity, is Oprah Winfrey. A lot of, I was one of those kids that would come home after school and watch the Oprah Winfrey Show.
Really?
Wow.
And on TiVo or what have you, because, you know, I wasn't home when it aired.
Yeah.
But a lot of Oprah's words have shaped who I am, the things that I, how I move. Like, when she speaks, she's prophetic. Is that what they, is that what it is? Like, I think of like Maya Angelou for her. Someone whose words of wisdom just are always in the back of your mind. I remember watching her final show. And one of the things she said that stuck with me and it really got a battery on my back was, you are responsible for your own life. And that to me was like, bitch. Yeah. Pull it together right now.
Mm-hmm. Were you silent or were you silenced? That also stuck with me.
Raquel?
Oh my gosh, there are so many, but the one that comes to mind for me as a mother is Monica Roberts. Mm-hmm. She was an iconic Black trans woman who had an award-winning blog, Trans Griot, and she was really the first Black trans journalist that I knew who was like, oh, you can tell specific stories about our community, right? Like, mm-hmm. we matter that much that you should be invested in that. And she was doing that, like, in the mid-2000s, y'all. Like, mm-hmm. way before the visibility era. Unfortunately, she passed in 2020, but she was always so encouraging. Mm-hmm. And when she passed, I looked on her blog, and there were so many moments where she was just, like, celebrating the wins of, like, Black trans folks in our community, including me. Like, mm-hmm. I saw her. She had these posts that I didn't even know existed at the time that she was alive, that she was saying, look at what Raquel is doing. This is amazing. Mm-hmm. So she is an eternal mother for me.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Okay. So next, there's a quote by Sylvia Rivera that says, I was wearing makeup in the fourth grade. I did it because I liked makeup. I didn't think anything was wrong with it. What toy that's often gendered do you think was the most fun? Dolls or trucks?
Well, definitely dolls. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up really loving to like dress the Barbies. I had a girl cousin, and those were the only times I could actually play with the Barbie dolls because I wasn't allowed to have them on my own. And I remember going over to her apartment when I was younger, and my family made an obscure rule that I could play with dolls, but I couldn't play with Barbies. It's very strange. I don't know what the rationale. Maybe I'll unpack that.
Like a baby doll, but not a Barbie?
I guess because, like, I don't know. That's really interesting. I'm going to ask her when I see her at Christmas. but, yeah, definitely Barbies and dolls. Love the hair, love the dresses, and love the story building.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would think for me it would have been Barbie dolls. Or baby dolls.
Those are different.
Dolls. Because of the I think of Sims kind of. I used to love The Sims, but mm-hmm. you have these like characters that you get to create worlds with based on your own imagination. Mm-hmm. And so that for me was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to lie. I liked my little cars, mm-hmm. Which I guess people wouldn't expect. But I didn't really have access to dolls either. I loved stuffed animals. Like, I had a whole collection of stuffed animals up until an embarrassing age.
You have collectible Beanie Babies?
I had the Beanie Babies, too.
I was like, I hope you didn't throw those out.
You was in Black Friday going wild for the Beanie Babies?
Yes. I had Beanie Babies. I had everything. And I guess that was fine. Like, mm-hmm. you know, my parents never said anything about that. So that was my compromise, was like all those stuffed animals were my characters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mine was, I guess, somewhere in the middle. Like, I loved Power Rangers, which is kind of like a doll. It's basically, they were all like little dolls. I'm just now, like, when I really think, I'm like, they made it, it's like boy doll, but whatever. But like, with them, they always, they had their whole life. I was like, we got to reenact the whole show that just happened here. Everybody get on set.
In action.
Okay, so the next question. The title of the chapter in your book that highlights Sylvia Rivera is Our Ancestors' Wildest Nightmare. What would be your wildest nightmare? Going to a drag brunch with George Santos or Disney World with Ron DeSantis?
Would it be a sweet dream or a beautiful nightmare?
Definitely Disney with DeSantis. Cause George Santos, like, it's just funny.
It's gonna be funny,
and I can laugh now that he is not in the house.
Right.
Okay.
So I can feel a little bit, you know, without guilt.
It's like the punchline.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Whereas the other thing is still quite dangerous.
It's very dangerous.
No, yeah. I was going to pick George because I was thinking about how much fun that would be.
Mm-hmm. But it's a nightmare.
Pull that corporate card out, girl.
Meanwhile, it's your money that he's using.
It the is. Gag.
Take you
well,
out.
That's why. Mm-hmm. Pull it out.
I have the same answer. I'm not going to Florida.
Okay. And then
it's just all of Florida, just blacklisted.
And then Raquel, one final question for you, and we ask all of our guests. What are you curious about?
What am I curious about? Ooh.
Fun, serious, light, whatever you want it to be.
I'm definitely curious about this Renaissance film. I'm also curious about cis folks these days and their issues with gender in a different way. And that has come up a lot on the book tour. Like, there's been a lot of cis folks asking about gender, and I'm like, oh, you're curious about this. And now I'm curious about why you're so
curious. I'm
curious
about what's going on in your head.
Yes.
Okay. Love that. Okay.
Listen, stay curious.
Stay curious. Actually, no, go read a book. Buy and read a book.
Yes.
All right. So we'll move into our conversation now. So the book's title comes from the Elizabeth Apple quote, "And the day came when the risk to remain tight in a bud was more painful than the risk it took to blossom." When was this moment? When was the moment for you in relation to your either sexuality for the group here or gender identity? I can start again, I guess. I know the moment where I felt like, you know, I can't, I have to bloom. It was literally the night I moved to before I moved to New York. It was my last night in Boston. I remember, and I've told you this story, but I remember my mom called and was like, oh, well, she asked me some random question about like having kids or something.
Yeah, I know the story.
And it sent me into a spiral. And I remember I called my dad like 9, 10 o'clock, and I'm leaving for like New York at like 6 a.m. And I was just like, mom was asking me all these questions. I'm gay. I can't do it anymore. I'm moving to New York, and like, I wanted New York to be like that blooming for me. Like, I had spent that year becoming comfortable with myself. I had spent the year like talking to my friends about who I was. And then it was that point where I was just like, there's nothing else that I want to hold in. And I think that was the point. It's so singular. I think a lot of times you ask people things, they're just like, well, it was kind of this ongoing thing. I have this very singular moment I thought about when I was like looking at that quote, and I was like, wow, there was this moment for me.
Yeah. I think I also had an experience with my mom similar to you. Not similar to that experience, but there's been multiple times over the course of my life that I felt like there's been like a blooming of my identity and expression. But one that comes to mind, I think, is probably about 8 years into me moving into New York. For me, New York was sort of like, New York and DC was sort of like a runaway from home, where it was just kind of like, all right, I'm done with home, and now I can like spread my wings and, you know, be who I know myself to be. And then something happened where I was just like, I feel kind of estranged from my family. I feel like I like want my family to be more involved in this aspect of my life. And I remember when I was in my first long-term relationship, I just, you know, told my mom that I wanted her to actually like meet my partner. And that was something that I had never done before. And so, you know, when she came up to New York and we all went to brunch and we all hung out, and it was just this really beautiful moment. Even though I felt like my mom didn't necessarily know how to navigate the conversation, she didn't really know where to take the conversation. I think that she was present, you know, she was there, and she was optimistic. And I think in some strange way, I think it actually helped me get over the shame of PDA. And after that experience, I kind of become a bit more comfortable just kind of being public with my affection for another man. Because I think up until then, I was definitely, you know, gay and active.
You were being affectionate.
But, you know, when you go outside, it's like, don't hold my hand. Like, let's not make ourselves a target. And I think that that small, like, leap of faith of bringing my mom into my world and her just kind of like just rolling with it and just kind of like adjusting in real time, I think it gave me the confidence to be a bit more open with public displays of affection.
That's beautiful.
Yeah,
that is so beautiful. There's so many moments in the book, of course, but I think one of the big moments for me around Blooming, of course, was really dealing with the loss of my father. And I talk about this in the book. But one of the things for me as a Black trans woman and now as an author was to try and articulate that weirdness of like mourning my father, but also the weird kind of relief of not having his expectations anymore. Yeah. And particularly his expectations around me to grow up and have this kind of life that was the epitome of Black masculinity. And so I think that that's something that a lot of folks can resonate with, but that was a moment where I was called to bloom.
Yeah.
That letter to your father, I was boohoo crying on a train in public. I was a little bit embarrassed because someone was just like, what are you reading right now? But that really, that section in particular really stood out to me. We talked about it a little bit earlier in the season, but I also had a challenging relationship with my father around his expectations of what he thought I should be as his son, and just kind of like this push and pull of, you know, what he wanted versus what I wanted. And so the way that you wrote it was just so beautifully, and thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Yeah, the dynamics between your father and yourself were really the soft parts for me. I was I found myself getting emotional, and I didn't grow up with my father in the household, and so having that feeling of living up to dad's expectations, I never really had, because he wasn't in the household. Had he been in the household, maybe I would have been like, you know, had that fear sort of, or that pressure that I put on myself to live up to whatever that standard of masculinity is. And when I think about this question of why it's more painful to remain tight in that bud versus the moment when you take the risk to bloom. And so I thought about that hard, and I found a little something on the internet. And I'm thinking about, why do people not take the risk to bloom? And so according to a study by the Williams Institute, which surveyed 354 agencies that work with LGBTQIA plus homelessness populations, 50% of all teens get a negative reaction from their parents when they come out. One in four teens are forced to leave their homes after coming out to their parents, and 68% of teens have experienced family rejection after coming out to their family. So when we're thinking about the risk that it takes, those are the risks. You know, what's going to happen when I reveal who I am to my family? Am I going to be disowned? Are they going to kick me out? What does that look like? You know, and I think a lot of us tend to want to wait until we feel secure, or we're unleashed from depending on them to be able to reveal ourselves to them. And so for me, the point in time that I took the risk to bloom was really in college. You know, a rose is still a rose. A rose is still a rose. So I had always been blooming, but it was that liberation of living on my own, being away outside of the home, away from family, and kind of having Pandora's box in college and being able to live my own life gave me the liberation I needed to even more fully come into who I was.
I also like thinking about that, about all the statistics around queer youth. It also speaks to why there's so much importance for things like Star House with Sylvia Rivera's work, for chosen families and what we were talking about. We talk about queer parents and things. It's because that exists, but then like, what do we do with it? I was about to say a rose that grew from concrete. That's so cheesy. But like, but I think about like when you're put under harsh circumstances, people find ways to love. People find ways to connect. People find ways to build family. And to get the things that, if you're not going to give it to me by birth, it's not because I don't deserve it, and it's not because there aren't people in this world that are willing to give it to me, give it to us. And I think even we had an episode last season with our parents on, and it's been years and they've come a very long way. And one of the things that my mom was talking about, she was just like, what is the option? You lose your child, and because they'll find love, they'll find their people, they'll find the thing, they just would live and continue to do it without you. Mm-hmm. And are you okay with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a balance, right? Because I the chosen family spaces obviously are so important, and mm-hmm. honestly, other communities know what that's like, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's important just across the board for people on the margins. And one of the things that I'm often talking about with, like, my other, like, Black trans girls, the dolls, is, like, this, it's almost like a question of, well, who, like, I'm fabulous and fly and beautiful now, mm-hmm. but who would I have been if I could have been more of myself from the start? Mm-hmm. And it's not so much a lamenting the girlhood or maybe the expansive gender experience I could have had when I was younger, but it's more of an opportunity of, like, what can we do to encourage the parents, the guardians, the adults in young people's lives now to understand that we all need the freedom to figure out ourselves mm-hmm. on our own terms.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
We have to have a lot of humility around our expectations and making sure that they're not suffocating the next generations coming up. Mm-hmm. And a lot of parents and guardians and adults have issues with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, a thing that stuck out to me in your book was sort of your experience of being open with your identity with your mother, mm-hmm. and then, you know, receiving the recommendation or the advice to maybe hold off a bit to reveal that information to your father. And
it was a strong suggestion.
Yes. And, you know, I really resonated with that because mm-hmm. I came out first to the women in my family. Mm-hmm. And then it was at the women's recommendation to hold off on telling the men. And so when you think about adding that layer as well, of like, it's a really fine line between, like, are you protecting your child from, you know, from the harms of the world by telling them that they should never engage with it? Or are you harming them by making them feel like they're not allowed to be who they are? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of I tussled back and forth in my mind of, like, were they doing this? Like, I know that they had good intentions, but, like, look at what the end result was. It's mm-hmm. me looking back on my life and thinking, what would have the outcome been if I was just encouraged the entire time mm-hmm. instead of being like, no, not yet. Wait until you're 18, or wait until you're 21, or wait until you're out the house, or wait until, you know, the perfect time that doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
It doesn't. I mean, and to your point, so, I mean, for people listening, like, I lost my father at 19. Mm-hmm. I came out as gay at 14 to my mom, 15 to my dad. And if I had held off until I graduated from high school, I would have came out to my dad at 18.
Yeah.
Which means all of the, like, healing that did happen and the bridges that were built in that meantime, that time period would have been so shortened. Mm-hmm. And so who knows the state of our relationship when he did actually pass when I was 19.
Yeah. Well, you were telling your mother, like, while I'm here, the healing can start.
This right. is before while I'm stuck in the
so
house.
So that was kind of like a that whole thing, the way that happened. Mm-hmm. Was sort of divine intervention, just because you had that time that you didn't know you weren't going to be able to have later on.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that that's something that young queer and trans folks have to do all the time. It's like, we have to pick up the slack for the adults in our lives who are ill-equipped
yeah.
mm-hmm. to understand or take care of us, right? Just like all of us here mm-hmm. had to figure out ways to thrive and survive outside of their watch, mm-hmm. We end up having to strategize
yeah.
our mm-hmm. lives in ways that maybe youth shouldn't have to.
Right. Yeah.
Or, like, even just young adults. Like, I remember I came out to my parents, and I have the opposite effect. I would talk to my dad, who would then talk to my mom. And my first partner, they were coming to meet him, and my mom was like, I don't think I'm ready. And I told my dad, I was like, well, she can stay at home at somebody else's house.
Because well, I said, you said that? I couldn't even
have the spirit to fuck these people. And, but, like, even still, like, me at 20, I was 25, 26. Like, why does that have to be the first conversation I have about a major partner with my parents? Mm-hmm. Like, if it were my, well, I have a gay brother too, but if my, the straight ones. I mean, I'm like, oh, this is my first, like, serious partner. They were bringing them home or wanted to introduce them for the holidays. It will be this welcome, exciting thing. And they never have to think about.
As a teenager. It,
mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Right. 10 years before
exactly.
you.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So we've been waiting, honey.
So Raquel, when we talk about your book, which is a memoir, at the first stop of your book tour, which we had the pleasure of attending, so beautiful. Laverne did her thing. It was such an exciting moment. Someone in the audience asked you why you thought the genre of trans memoir was important, to which you responded, as much as this is a trans memoir, it's a Black one. It's also that of a Southern person. So how has your experience as a Black Southern person colored the journey of your trans experience?
Mm, okay. You're like... Gail King who? We love Gail. I love Gail so much.
We do love Gail.
Yeah, no, I, my Southernness in particular has colored my, I mean, it's really tied up in my Blackness too, right? Because I, for me, being Black and Southern is like so crucial when I talk about my identity, because there's something about being so close to the source of so much of the oppression in American history, particularly around enslaved Africans. And this was something I didn't really realize until I was older, obviously, because we already had an educational system that was, bereft of like the fullness of our experiences, not to mention all the CRT conversations now and stuff around curricula. But to grow up in Augusta, Georgia, for me, was growing up on land that was just miles away from like where my people had been for 200 years at least. So that means I was more than likely going to school with folks who were descendants of folks who were also enslaved, of course, but also descendants of folks who did the enslaving. And so I think that that's such an interesting exercise to think about the way that oppression is kind of erased because of distance and because of the powers that be that say we shouldn't discuss these things in their totality. Because nobody wants accountability, right? Especially the ones with power. So that's a thing. And I, when I think about my transness, I think that historical feeling of being othered as a Black person comes up as a similar experience. I also think about later on when I was going out into the world and being a community organizer, you know, there's a way when I talk about being Southern that people are like, oh, you know, they almost do the kind of like reverse bless your heart thing where it's, they have all of these assumptions about what my experience was like. And it's like, yeah, there were certain struggles there. Yeah, I didn't have access to huge queer metropolitans like New York or San Francisco. But also, queer and trans people have always been in the South. And so it's a disservice for us to only think of the South as a place of oppression when we know that so many of our social justice movements would not exist without the struggle, the resistance, and resilience that has happened historically in the South. So all of that is important to me when I talk about my transness, because we don't get enough of that flavor. Right. Transness is a thing that is, especially in Black community, discussed as this white thing that was created in a lab in academia somewhere and then exported into our communities. And it ignores that actually it was white supremacy and colonialism that stripped the expansive ideas around sexuality and gender that indigenous folks around this world, including Africans, already had.
Your point about the story's not being told, like we see it all the time, right? When we look at some of the more mainstream representation that we're seeing of trans folks, it is taking place in New York. It is taking place in San Francisco, and we don't get that that storytelling from a Southern perspective, a Black mm-hmm. perspective. And so those were the things that really stuck out to me as well in the memoir. And also bringing in your Catholic upbringing as well, I thought was very a very different approach to religion, not approach to religion, but like a different variety of religion that we're used mm-hmm. to. And so I loved how, you know, you made it a point to talk about those points of intersection, even your experience of being at UGA mm-hmm. and not really having that Black community around you. I'm just curious, like, in your experience on campus, it seems like you were able to really, really evolve in your sort of expression of who you were at UGA, being that you had a bit more independence there. I'm just curious how race impacted your overall development.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting to think about when I was contemplating where I would go to college. Because mm-hmm. for me, being one of the benefits I had of being out at like 14 and 15 to my parents and pretty much everyone I had grown up with was that I was able to articulate to my parents that I needed their, you know, blessing to go to a place where I could thrive as a young queer and trans person. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't want to feel isolated in the ways that I had felt all throughout my life up until that point. So I applied to a lot of schools and none in Georgia, because I was like adamant to get out of Georgia, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. I had this idea, just as I was just saying, that the South was a place where my queerness and my transness, it didn't line up with this place. And mm-hmm. I would have to go somewhere else to feel more liberated, which I think is a horrible thing, right? I think it's a horrible thing that so many of us feel like we at least have to leave, if not our region and our city, we have to leave our homes mm-hmm. to be liberated. Yeah. Like, that means we need to be building healthier homes, mm-hmm. but I'm sure we'll get to that. So in college, I mean, I ended up going to the University of Georgia because I got the in-state scholarship, and my parents was like, oh, you going to Georgia? And so I went there. I found queer and trans people, and there, of course, were Black students. But there was such a feeling that, like, I had to make a choice of whether it's almost like sorting. It's almost like the sorting hat from
mm-hmm. Harry Potter.
From that one novel.
Oh, by that woman.
That one fantasy series. yes, from Harry Potter.
By that person.
And yes, J.K. Rowling is a mess. But we know that that series defines so many of our childhoods. But yeah, I mean, it's almost like that sorting experience yeah. in college. Or like Mean Girls, when Damien is like going and saying, oh, that's where those people are at that table and all of that. I felt like I had to make a choice between being with the Black students, which would require me to dim my queerness and queerness at that point, or I would do more things with the queer student groups and be a bit tokenized as one of the few Black students who made that choice to be in those groups.
Yeah.
So it was a different time. I think people also forget in the early 2010s, marriage equality was not a thing. Mm-hmm. So being openly gay, even if you were cis, was very stigmatized in a way that probably is like unfathomable to like younger folks now. Mm-hmm. Not to mention being trans later on in my college experience.
Right.
So I felt like I had to make a choice and bifurcate my identities.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that spoke to me was from a very young age, you always knew that you had something to say. And I got something to say. And one of the themes that kept reemerging throughout the book was the idea of belonging. And so from your speech at the Women's March to your time working at OUT, like, what gives you the confidence to continue speaking up in spaces that don't cater to Black queer or Black trans experiences?
Yeah. Well, I think to one of your points, Jordan, around blooming, I mean, you were alluding to the fact that blooming is something that can happen over and over again. Mm-hmm. Like, I hope when people read the book that they understand that I'm not saying that I'm fully bloomed, honey, and it's done. I'm really talking about various moments, and I think we all have multiple moments throughout mm-hmm. our lives where we're called to bloom. It's almost like muscle memory. Like, when you go through taking risks and blooming, it becomes kind of second nature. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you almost feel guilty when you're in spaces where you don't speak up. Mm-hmm. And I don't like that feeling.
'Cause you feel like it's your responsibility to...
Yeah, it's my responsibility to now. I kind of felt that when I was younger, too. I think when I came out in high school, I kind of had this feeling that, like, even though it might be hard on the other side, maybe it would make it easier for other folks. Mm-hmm. Mm. Because I knew we existed, largely because I had access to the internet, and child, I was in those chat rooms and forums, all of that.
I'm like, did you have the same internet I had? Because, baby, it just took so long.
Which internet? Were you on Beyonce's internet?
I don't know. Oh, you know. I was on the AOL. Messenger. I was in the Boondocks, the Sticks. But I feel like in Georgia, it was similar. I had dial-up,
Well, we all ended up having DSL. DSL later. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So maybe... It wasn't quite dollar.
Well, you figured it out.
I figured it out, honey. And I was also lucky, too, because my mom taught, like, typing and, like, business office technology. Mm-hmm. So she would just give me her hand-me-down computer. But I think that when you take those risks, it becomes almost second nature. But I think the other thing is history, like knowing that there were Black trans folks in particular who existed and were outspoken, like Marsha P. Johnson, trans folks of color like Sylvia Rivera. Learning about them as an adult, I was like, it felt like I had fuel for whenever I felt down or like disillusioned around the state of the world, which is often these days.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If they could do it in their times, mm-hmm. when there was even less language and tools to be ourselves and less access and resources for folks like us, then I can do it. And also, I want to leave the door open for the next folks who are coming through, too. Mm-hmm.
100%. That's part of the work, right?
It is. It is. And I think we can all do that. Like, it doesn't have to be necessarily at the bullhorn in the streets or at the podium at these mm-hmm. big marches. It's in our everyday lives, mm-hmm. right? It's like you're nibbling seeing you be your full queer self, right? That can mean a lot to a young person, whether they're queer or not, right? Yeah. It can, mm-hmm. 'cause we're all different in some way.
Yep. No, speaking of looking back on history and the impact that other queer and trans advocates have made on the community. Let's talk about Sylvia Rivera's famous speech at the 1973 Christopher Street Liberation Day rally. It's very, very emotional. And she rails against what we would consider probably whitewashing and classist approach to queer liberation. In the speech, she talks about the fact that queer liberation had only truly included white, cisgendered, middle class men and women. Mm-hmm. And you wrote in your book that Rivera's theory of change foreshadowed today's assimilationist, ultra-capitalist, and neoliberal LGBTQ plus movement. So my question is, looking back on our personal experiences, what role do we think we played in that system, and how has your view of queer liberation evolved over time?
Yeah. Whew. That's a big question. So my point in talking about kind of the shortcomings of the past, at least in terms of LGBTQ plus movement, is to really spell out that a lot of what I guess we attribute to this time, these conversations around intersectionality, these conversations around white supremacy, the cis heteropatriarchy, really have threads in the fights of previous generations, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there it's important to paint a through line for the resistance of queer and trans people of color, because again, we're so erased from the conversation, and people think of LGBTQ plus folks only as white, right? Or only mm-hmm. in a particular mode. Mm-hmm. And not only were there folks of color and trans folks, but there were folks who were calling out these systems of oppression and articulating this, right? Mm-hmm. In a powerful way. And Sylvia Rivera did not need academia Mm-mm. to see these things, mm-hmm. right? All she needed to do was understand her power.
Yeah.
So that feels important. But I think it's also that we glorify the visibility or the ascension of the LGBTQ plus movement, and particularly the normalcy mm-hmm. that is often attached to some parts of our community, usually just cis, gay, and lesbian folks. And we ignore that radical element that all of us in some way can tap into mm-hmm. is what's going to lead us into a better space collectively. I often think about the 1970s, like this like immediate era right after Stonewall, which Stonewall, first of all, our like seminal moment in our history, was a queer militant uprising against the New York Police Department. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's abolitionist as fuck. That's black and brown as fuck. It was also a gender diverse group. It was like drag performers. It's all the people that are like really on the chopping block yeah. right now in terms of legislation. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's why Sylvia was not going to miss a moment.
Exactly. And then so after that era, though, there was a concerted effort by cis, mostly wealthy cis white gay men in particular, but of course some women, to have a gay political lobbying agenda. Mm-hmm. And that meant they were going to fight for their rights, of course, but they felt like they could only do that if they said no to the freaks. Mm-hmm. And that meant the trans people who did exist before yesterday. And the drag performers. And so part of the problem that I see now with the conservative agenda here, I mean, talking about Project 2025, right, and all of these conservatives who are really trying to paint a world where queer and trans people can't be our fullest selves at any age, mm-hmm. around healthcare, around education, et cetera, is that they're just taking advantage of the cracks and the fissures that were left by folks in our own community generations ago who wanted to distance themselves from, in some ways, the queerest parts of our community. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem.
I was going to say, I think a lot, like, I think about the very first episode of our show that we did. And I think about the ideas of respectability and, like, when we started this and how much it's made me think about it doing this and trying to, in some way, speak about, have conversations with people of so many varied experiences. And we came into this as, like, three dudes that work in corporate America who all went to Howard, who are cisgendered. And I think that, and we recorded the very first episode of our show, like, the weekend in 2020 that the George Floyd protests started. And we had this very heated exchange about respectability and the idea of being like the good Negro. And I think that like that conversation like filters so much of this into this idea of being like the good gay. And I think that for me, and it's something that I have tried to do a lot of unlearning around, and just like thinking about the level of privileges that I have in the life that I've lived. Like, I grew up in a home with both my parents. I've went to school. I'm now married. I'm just like, but I in no way want to fight for that to be the view.
My body is like falling apart, honey. I'm poor.
But for me, I just think it's important for us to not be the advocate for saying that that is the way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is one of many experiences that are varied. And I think that the point you made, like, you don't need academia to be a voice, to be valuable. And I think that we've had so many people on this show that whose backgrounds are different than ours. And I've learned so much from everyone in so many different types of ways. And I think that to me is what I find compared to other people. I find exciting about a queer community. In my head, like when I first came out, and it's partly due to some of the most amazing people I met when I lived in Boston, it was, we weren't fighting to be normal. And I was just meeting interesting people who were different. And I was like, is this what a queer community was? Well, boy, did I learn a lot since that 22-year-old little baby gay. But I hope for more of that. Like, I remember that experience and I loved it. And I loved the fact that I was just meeting people who were like all just fucking being, not being strange, not being normal, not being different, not being like the same, just being. And I think that that is such a more valuable thing. And it's, if we talk about liberation, because like that is what liberation is now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
I think that I had a later revelation than Damon. I think that when I finally got to a place where I was out to my family and I felt like I was making progress, something clicked in me where I was just like, okay, the hard part is over. Now, like, let's just try to figure out how to make your life as comfortable as possible. And I think that I selfishly was, you know, moving forward through my life being like, all right, the gay part is known, people know it. How can I make sure that these external parties don't get too distracted by that? And so does that mean that I need to be excellent at work? Does that mean that I need to make a certain amount of money so that people can put some respect on my name? Does that mean that I'm not going to experiment, even, you know, for fun, with gender nonconformity? And I feel like for a long time, that was sort of my strategy to be able to be confident in my gayness, but also feel safe in it. And I think that for me, I had a late blooming around being more inclusive with my approach to liberation from this show. And this show has required me to do a lot of reading, which I felt like was the key. It wasn't until I actually make a concerted effort to learn about the experiences and the stories of other people within the queer experience that I developed a stronger understanding, and as a byproduct grew a stronger sense of compassion. And I think that once you have that, then I felt like I was able to say, like, no, like, now I can go into a situation and be like, that's not right. This isn't right. Why are we not saying something about this? But I think before that, I was shielding myself so much from other parts of the queer community because I didn't want to feel that oppression again after I got what I believed was a sense of normalcy.
Right. And that's why through this podcast journey, I've come to understand that until all of us are free, none of us are free. Mm-hmm. And what that means is until the what people deem at who's at the bottom of the totem pole of this whole like spectrum that we're on, until folks from the lowest of the totem pole to the highest, as people may deem it, are free, then we should still be in this fight together. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what you're saying, Jordan, is it resonates with me because we think about ourselves a lot. And when you have that mentality of, I got mine, all right. Mm-hmm. It's a very selfish, self-centered mentality. And when people feel like they're secure and they're good,
then, you know, they kind of like wipe their hands of it. And they don't pay attention to what's going on, or they do pay attention and they see it, but silence, which is violence. So I think having these conversations and continuing to have these conversations and broaden our horizons for ourselves, for people who will listen to this, is important. And that's the pledge that I think that we've made to continue doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And Raquel, we have one more question for you.
Okay.
But according to womenshistory.org, at Stonewall for six nights, the 17-year-old Sylvia Rivera refused to go home or to go to sleep, saying, "I'm not missing a minute of this. It's the revolution." Mm-hmm. Looking forward, what does the future for queer revolution look like for you? And how do you think that we can do a better job collectively as a community to include Black trans people?
Mm. The future of queer revolution. Let me get my Miss Cleo on.
Miss Cleo.
Honestly, I say this a lot nowadays, but I feel like I have a lot of humility around identity and like how we think about identity now. Because we talk about our experiences in ways that like our elders are like, what? Mm-hmm. You know, because like queer and trans folks are just so fucking creative and innovative. Like it shifts so quick. Like our culture is on warp speed in comparison to everywhere else. And so for me, I'm becoming more curious about how we can get everyone to kind of understand that they're gender nonconforming. Mm-hmm. Especially in the Black community, we're all gender nonconforming because we've never been able to access these ideals of manhood or masculinity or womanhood or femininity in the ways that our white counterparts have in a white supremacist society. Mm-hmm. And I mean, similarly, they will never be able to achieve those ideals because they're ideals. And so I hope we can move into a space where there's a lot more freedom for all of us to just express ourselves, to have bodily autonomy, to be the drivers of our own destinies. And when I think about being trans, it's not really so different to me than cis folks' experiences. Like, I had a boyhood, and just like all of y'all, I'm sure, there were moments where I was told I couldn't express certain emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And regardless of gender, when you tell people they can't express certain parts of themselves that are key and intrinsic, you're telling them they can't fully be human.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think about women and girls, particularly cis women and girls who are told they can't be strong and confident or capable folks without living up to somebody else's expectations, I think that that's something that anybody of any gender experience can understand. And so for me, I think in the future we're going to have less conversations around this new kind of invisible binary that there are cis and there are trans people. I think we'll just kind of understand that they're just people who have a gender experience and deserve to be as free in that as anyone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking a lot about the idea of queer revolution, and I always think about, I think you've gotten to the place of revolution when the people that aren't of an community or experience are the people standing up for it. Mm. And what I mean is that, And ironically, it's kind of the thing that trans people have been doing in the queer revolution since the beginning that maybe cis people need to take note of. Like, if you think about Sylvia Rivera standing up for all queer people,
mm-hmm.
And you think about us, hopefully, through, I guess, right now, our tool is this show to create space and platforms and share stories like those of Raquel. I think a lot about last season when Tabitha Gonzalez came on, and one of the things she said that I was very, very proud of after the show, off camera. She was just like, I came here and you all made me feel safe. And when you think about the experiences, particularly of Black, brown, trans women, and the intersection of like not feeling safe physically or mentally going into certain spaces. And I hope that through this show, we can create a bubble here and through our listenership for people like Tabitha, Mother Lola Gucci, who came on with us, and then yourself, Raquel, where we are doing the work of standing up for, speaking up for, showing the beauty and the humanity of all people, even if their experiences is different than ours.
Mm-hmm. You hit the nail on the head. Because, okay. Like, can we all have more compassion and humanity for others?
Yeah.
Whose experiences may not look like our own. Mm-hmm. That's for me, it's so simple to me. But it's really such a complex thing, and like people can't grasp the concept of it because no one wants to mind their own business. They want to mind yours, yeah. and yours, but they don't want to see, you know, let a person have their freedom to express themselves and be who they are. Mm-hmm. They want to criticize, they want to judge, they want to shame, they want to blame, they want to all of those things, and it's just so unnecessary. But you wrapped it up in a bow for me in a way that, the way that I like bows wrapped.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when I think about the future of liberation, I think about just the power of the internet. I have to talk about this stuff all day, every day at work. But like, what I'm seeing is the distribution of information and stories and art being democratized. And I think that as we move forward through life, I think that there's going to be less gatekeepers that are saying, this is the queer story that we're going to tell. This is the aspect of humanity that we're going to tell. We may show this portion of the community, but this is through the lens that we're going to tell it. And what I'm seeing start already, and what I would love to see happen more, is that members of our community understand that you can create your own table now. Mm-hmm. And the barriers to entry are lower than ever to be able to have your art, your narrative, your story told, and for people to understand that you don't have to wait around for someone to deem your identity or your humanity important. Mm-hmm. You can create that for yourself and galvanize an audience with the internet and being able to take your skill set and your passion and turn it into something that people are going to love and consume, similar to the book, you know? And so I just see people taking more of their power and sharing those stories and taking control of the narrative.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's wild to have written this book. I'm still, you know, trying to like wrap my head around it. But I think similar to like what y'all have all been saying, like it's, for me, I want to encourage other folks, Black trans folks, of course, but like other folks to know that they can tell their story on their own terms. Mm-hmm. And I feel very blessed to be able to do that and also be able to do work that elevates other folks so that they can tell their own stories too.
Yes.
Like, we don't need a fucking filter.
Okay. Take the power and tell your fucking story.
Yeah.
Speaking of your work, for the people who are watching this podcast or listening to this podcast, what can they, where can they find out more about your projects, what you have coming up? How can they follow you or stay in touch with you?
Well, you can find me at RaquelWillis.com, RaquelWillis.com. And find me on, you know, the interweb, socials, get The Risk It Takes to Bloom, wherever you get fabulous literary works. And also check out a podcast I'm hosting called Afterlives, which focuses on the experiences of trans folks we've lost too soon. The first season is out now, and it focuses on Layleen Polanco, a trans woman who died in Rikers custody in 2019.
Well, thank you so much, Raquel, for coming to the show with us. I'm so happy that, you know, we had alignment and we're able to have this conversation today.
Yeah.
And everyone, make sure that you go out and get a copy of The Risk It Takes to Bloom. It was a very emotional read and a very beautifully written book. Thank you for sharing your story.
Yes, she's a page turner.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. That's all the time that we have this week. This season of Surface Level is presented by MOBI, Mobilizing Our Brothers Initiative. If you enjoyed this episode, let's keep the conversation going. Let us know your thoughts and questions at surfacelevelpodcast.com. And remember, stay curious.